Welcome to the Social Media Church Podcast, the place for conversations with church leaders about social media. And you are tuned in to episode number 104. I am your host, DJ Chuang. Thank you for tuning in. On this episode, we have a conversation with the church leader of church leaders who worked at Leadership Network back in the late 90s. And has been described as one of the fathers of the emergent church movement, quote unquote. His official bio describes him as a possibility enthusiast who seeks to find creative, entrepreneurial, and generative ways to enlist people to join in the hopes, dreams, and desires God has for the world. So a very positive, optimistic kind of guy. Doug is officially also the national director of the CANA Initiative, which is a collective of faith-engaged organizations and individuals that seek to embody a generous Christian ethos, leading to a constructive collective action in the United States. And he is also the founding pastor of Solomon's Porch, a holistic, missional Christian community in Minneapolis, Minnesota. He's also a speaker, consultant, author of 7 books that he will mention. Doug is also a podcaster and a weekly radio show that is currently on pause. He's authored a bunch of books on spirituality and Christianity. He's also an ultra marathoner and a swimmer. And he's ventured from the mega church to the missional community to the emergent church. And I was very curious to find out how social media has played a role in all of that and how social media has facilitated conversations for him and for his community over these years. Now let's welcome Doug Padgett to the Social Media Church Podcast.
DJ, how are you? Nice to see you.
I'm doing well. What are you up to these days? You've had quite a spiritual journey over the years, going from a mega church world and into the missional emergent church world. Wikipedia has you noted as one of the founders of the emergent church movement, and you're author of a number of books.
Hey, I'm a founder. I would appreciate founding father, but they don't use that kind of language so much anymore.
You're not old enough.
Right. It's funny because I think you're right. There's times where I sit and look back and think, I didn't grow up religiously. So I kind of came into Christianity without anything, and evangelicals welcomed me in, and I worked in that kind of mega church world and did all that stuff. And then I worked at Leadership Network, which is, I think, when we met, did the kind of networking and then started one of these little missional kind of communities in Minneapolis. And it all can seem, and then social media stuff, right? Tony and I started a company that does church leader training, including social media training, which we don't really do anymore because other people can do it, or most people don't really need it, frankly. It can all seem super like haphazard, you know? But like a lot of people in my brain, it just all makes sense. It's like a really, not a straight path, but a really kind of visible path that one would take to do it. Like they all link together. It's all born out of the same impulse. They all come out of me. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's your story.
Yeah. Yeah. And it also, it all really feels like my introduction and conversion into Christianity, like that transition is just everything I do feels rooted in that. Like, I don't know. It's really curious. I don't even know if it is as rooted there as it feels like, maybe it's just that I'm the common denominator and all that. So, I'm everywhere I've ever been kind of thing. So, I can't get away from myself.
Well, spiritually speaking, really, whether you're on the left side or the right side or connected, the liberal side or the conservative side, when you start your spiritual life, the Holy Spirit enters into you. So that's definitely a milestone, regardless of where you wind up theologically. But I have to ask, those years at Leadership Network change you in some way that blew up your theological bubble?
Well, yeah, in a way, I mean, because I was connected to so many people and saw so many different expressions. What it did for me more than anything, though, was reminded me that I didn't have a theological bubble or construct. I never approached it that way or thought of it that way, because partly because the way I came into Christianity and then my own temperament, it never felt to me like I had this thing that I was caring about. It always felt like it was user generated and created in the time and in the place. Because all the versions of Christianity that I was aware of, none of those were mine. I was sort of not denominational and post-denominational and post-evangelical even at the start, because, I had no familial connection to any of that, and was sort of welcomed in by the kind of Christians who said, hey, people should lead. And, you know, back then they called it, like, as a high school kid, you know, so they called it like student-led movements of spirituality. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's all people movement language. So then I went to college and studied anthropology, and all that people movement stuff came up again. So this kind of user-generated people movement thing was always in my brain and always thinking about that, which is partly why the social media part was interesting to me beyond just sort of the tactical side of it. And so I never really felt like I was not perfectly fitting in any of the versions of Christianity that I was kind of around, but I never felt like I was having to break something open or blow something up, or I just never had that kind of relationship to it.
Well, here's the thing. In conservative theology, the framework for theology and the practice of theology is actually very well defined, some more than others. And so to venture out of that, there's some emotional odds that a lot of people wrestle with, that they don't want to make that theological leap. And yet there's something stirring you that ties into who you are and, you know, God's work in you. Right. That you've found your own theological voice in this journey.
Yeah. And I hope this is true. I want it to be that it's as much a practice, or it's as much a way of being, a way of doing it, a way of doing theology, as it is the particular conclusions that I come to at any given point. And that was the part that, there was a time back in the 80s and into the early 90s when that's what the evangelicals that I was hanging around with all talked about. They talked about this theological process and this theological way and this, like, living the story of God in our day in ways that you sort of, you know, that that the Spirit of God is always opening this new frontier in front of us, and you're called into that, and you're to do theology in real time, in real space. And then something happened in evangelicalism. I mean, theories about what happened, but then it was taken over by the heartbeat of evangelicalism was filled by more people that had a particular process of theology, a particular way of getting there, and sets of conclusions. And so, I feel like, you know, if and some of this is just kind of bad memory, but I feel like, if we were in 1985 theologically, I wouldn't feel so distant from the kind of classical evangelical approach. I think maybe on the conclusions that I would draw, but you have to remember, like, evangelicals were big into C.S. Lewis and John Stott and, you know, and Henry Nouwen. Like, are you kidding me? You know what I'm saying? Like, those guys' processes, even the way they would talk, the way they came to their conclusions and the mechanisms they used to engage in that. They're not my theological conclusions, but I don't think they would be well, if it wasn't for their stature and sort of people's, you know, like, granting them a pass, if you tried to pull that stuff off now, I mean, you pull off just a decently argued C.S. Lewis approach to something, evangelicals would have no time for you. You couldn't do that. I couldn't do that. Carlos sitting right there couldn't do that. There's no way. But he gets a pat. And that's the thing that I mean that changed, not the conclusions, but the theological approach and the theological imagination. It's changed.
Yes, and you do like that word, imagination.
Because I think it's everything. Because I think it tells. I mean, I love it because it gives us these boundaries, right? Like, what, where, how far we're willing to go. How far can you think? How far can you conjure?
Yeah. Okay.
And also what the early evangelicals, I was with, you know, love that little phrase that God can do even more than we think or imagine. I really have loved that. Like, you know.
Ephesians 3:20-21.
Yeah.
For people that like to have that reference.
Yeah. To quote the verses.
And since we're talking for the Social Media Church podcast, the internet is 25 years old as we speak. So that means the internet was officially founded, launched, or described as the internet in 1999. So if you think back 25 years, which is before Twitter, before Facebook, before Google, we've come a long way in 25 years in terms of internet and how it's changed the world and how social media has changed the world. How would you say social media has contributed to your own spiritual journey?
Yeah, it's, you know, it has given, it's helped me to have a far broader set of connections with people. It's been very important. And it feels like it has given permission to create a different kind of para-denominational connectionalism, which is this thing I'm really into right now, like how we find ways to connect with people who are different than us. And in the old days, it was you were bound by location and time, and that often had to do with money and a lot of other things. So just getting your hands on the ideas of other people or having other people participate in your life. So the internet, as much as the social side, but really in the last 6 or 7 years, 8 years, the social side has become what I think was part of the sort of early imagination of the internet, right? Is that people were going to be self-creating and not just distributing content, but they were going to be having social engagement. So I find it to be the helpful framework. You know, I have this thing that I do in these books I write these books on the inventive age, and I suggest that there's four cultural periods: the agrarian age, the industrial age, the information age, and then time that I call the inventive age. And each of those has a time frame around them when they were prominent, and a way of organizing, a way of functioning. And churches are born in those different ages. So you have an agrarian age church, an industrial age church, and like the parish model or the agrarian age, and the industrial model gives us our modern day denominations. And evangelicalism was born in the information age. And then I think this inventive age really has the internet as its sort of picture, right? So when I do these presentations, I show a farm for the agrarian age, and I show a factory for the industrial age, and a television set for the information age. And the internet is really the communication and the terrain of this inventive age. So I think it's powerfully shaping and forming. And then the social media side, of course, is it's made it fun. I mean, frankly, I find people so much more interesting and frankly, so much funnier than I ever knew them to be when you engage with someone via social media. Because you just see another side of personalities. And, you know, I know there's a lot of curating that people do of their online persona and who they are and all that kind of stuff. But look, we do that everywhere anyway. You know, the clothes we wear and the hair products we use and the language we use and the movies we see. And, you know, we're always curating a sort of external identity versus an internal narrative. And that, so the internet, I think, or social media actually helps us to, I think it's helped people to recognize they do that far more than they ever knew they were doing that before. So I'm just all bullish on it. I think it's great. I think it's the future. I think we're better with it than without it. And, you know,
well, I actually have a job now that's virtual. So I work with a team in Virginia and New York, and I see them maybe 3 or 4 times a year. And all our conversations and work gets done in the cloud. And it's changing the shape of work. It's changing our commerce. It's changing our music and print industry and ideas, as you've described. So let's talk a bit about some of the various modes of social media that you have engaged with to expand your conversation and find those conversational partners. So you've been active in blogging, as well as podcasting?
Not anymore, though. I gave it up about 4 years ago, and I'll tell you why. But
okay, well, let's talk.
Yeah.
What happened in your blogging journey?
Well, I did blogging, and I've given it up. And at kind of every level, like I'm on, you know, like I don't even comment on blogs. I really even have a hard time reading them. Now, part of what's happened in the last few years is that blogs have transitioned from really have transitioned into sometimes for some people more of a website, and they're using a blogging technology to update the website. That's not what I mean. I mean the kind of, you know, what bloggers mean when they say I'm a blogger, right? It means that kind of written, linking commentary thing. And a lot of my friends who are big into it in other areas outside of religion remind me all the time about what good things happen in the true blogging kind of world. But you know, my industry and life and stuff is inside of religion, and it's not good for your blogging's not good for me. I can't do it in there. So I find the written form to be limited unless someone's really good at it on both sides, good at reading and good at written communication. And people aren't good at those things. And so what we're ending up with in my view is that people are not expressing themselves. I'm not against people expressing themselves at all. I want more of that. I don't think people have the skills to use the reading, writing modality on blogs in a way that accurately reflects who they are and who they want to be in the world. So for me, it doesn't seem like people are at their best in that world. Some are, and I get that. And I'm engaged in all that, on both ends, writers and, you know, listening and reading,
But blogging,
I had to step
away.
It's just the negativity, man. It's just unbelievable. And it's cheered on. And I think it's got to get worked out. I think it has a mixed martial arts like tonality to it, or to even be more cruel, I think it's like the NFL. And we're going to find down the road that those kinds of behaviors, even though people cheer them on, are really bad for the human being or brain or something. But you know, I've been wrong about more of my big predictions in life than right. So that easily could fall into the category of just another babbling middle-aged guy that thought blogging was a problem.
Useful for a season. And you yourself are a author of, I don't know how many books you've been published now.
I could tell you seven.
Yeah. Seven. Yeah. Hey, that's the perfect number. Yeah. And so blogging.
Boy, I should really leave it right there.
So as a writer, author, blogger, you're skilled and you've had practice to write. And there are classes you can take and courses you could take online to write. But there's no place where you can learn to read.
To read and engage. I know. Isn't that interesting? Like there's no remedial blog reading class. It's like we're just producing writers. Yeah, that's an interesting take. Maybe that's what you should do in the world.
Well, this is part of my exploration with this podcast, is having conversations with church leaders about social media and the whole interplay with that. And I find it to be a much more dynamic medium than blogging, where it's the written form, and this is much more of an interactive form in a contained manner. And then social media just blows it wide open, and it's perhaps too unstructured for some people to follow with that. So you yourself have also done talk radio and podcasting.
Yeah.
So I've gone the
talking side in order to, for two reasons. I like it. It fits me well. It fits my brain and my temperament and my energy level. Like I feel energized when I talk to people, and I feel differently when I write. So that's a lot of that's biography, you know? So I get that. But also people are more willing to be on a podcast or on a video cast than they are to write something for your blog. Right. So I found it's much better way to have access to people that I want to talk to. If I can run a radio show, either I've done a blog talk radio, I've done Spreaker radio, I've done what's called terrestrial radio, just over the air radio, and like you listen to in your car, you know, broadcast on an AM station. All of those, I like them all. I think they're all I think they're all the right way to go. But man, you can, I get to talk to all kinds of people when you say, hey, I'm doing a podcast. Would you come on my podcast? Because, you know, most people don't want to sit down and write. And if they can just take 15 minutes or something or 20 minutes to talk with you, they'll do it. If you say write a blog post, they're like, I don't have time for that. And I get that. And because again, most people haven't taken the classes in writing to be good at it. And they also, there's also something temporal about this. And I like that, where it feels like if you listen to a podcast or you watch a video cast, you're like, this was clearly in a certain time in certain place. Mm-hmm. But you read something someone wrote and that seems to last forever, right? Mm,
there's no time reference.
I get this. That's right. I get this a lot. People go back and they'll say like, hey, something you wrote back in 2002 on your blog. And then they'll say something like, okay, I know you said this on this podcast back in 2008. And I don't know if you think that anymore. Like people mm-hmm. hold it differently, right? Mm-hmm. There's something about it that just everything about the medium, when, you know, you ask somebody a question like we're doing right now, or I'm responding to your thoughts, people know I didn't prepare this in like, it's not overly gleaned, right? And it's not cleaned up, and it's not, where if you put something out on the internet in written form, people think that like, no, you kind of meant that, you know, like we really have a bias that when you write something, it's permanent and it's or it's higher, more highly curated. So anyway, I like all the feel that comes with the talking side of the internet.
And I've noticed,
I hope it's the future.
Part of this is my own hack at figuring out how to produce content that's more dynamic in shorter time.
Mm. Yeah.
So I can produce a podcast in, you know, the time it takes to record and upload, whereas a blog post, a 500-word blog post takes me well over an hour, 90 minutes to get my thoughts together and compose the words. And so, very different in terms of creating it as well as how it comes across. That's fascinating.
And people like to look more than they like to read. Like you see that on Facebook. Mm-hmm. You put up a Facebook post, people will read it, kind of. You put up a picture, you put up a video, and our brains are not as designed for reading as we like to think that they are. They're capable of it, but man, we are born with the ability to recognize and to see and to see images and pictures and all that kind of stuff. So which is why, you know, most of us have art, like I do in the office here. Like we have art around us, pictures, mm-hmm. and then we put books on shelves. Mm-hmm. Like that's a good, that's they're in the right places, you know?
Well, there are so many places that I could go with you, but for our listeners who are church leaders across the whole theological spectrum, how do we navigate a meaningful conversation in a pluralistic world that the social media world is, while holding on to our theological convictions for those that mm-hmm. like to hold on to it?
Yeah. And they do. I think it's a couple of things, including empathy. It's starting with those mirror neurons in our brains, right? The ability to empathize. And what I mean by that is asking yourself to try to understand why someone's idea is important to them. I mean, it's one thing to know what they're saying and to hear them clearly. That's good. And we should do that. It's a different kind of question though, to ask, why does that matter to you? Or to ask yourself, why does that matter to that person? Right. Because people think things for really, really important and interesting reasons. They don't always think very important and interesting things, but they think them for interesting and important reasons. So I think that part of the holding to our convictions is recognizing that other people have reasons that we can't always know as to why what they believe is important to them. Mm. And so I think it starts there. And if we don't have that, then you're just sort of, well, you're just listening to someone to the point that they're going to stop talking so you can say your next thing, right? Like it's kind of in tandem and not really in interplay.
Well, here's the thing. So not only do some church leaders have very strong convictions, part of their conviction is the role of being used to convert.
Yeah.
And you know, that's not true across the whole theological spectrum. So,
yeah, it should be more true with our progressive friends, I think. Like, and now this is understanding if conversion is the right is done in a humanizing way, right? Like people want to be converted. That's why you be converted all the time.
That's why I use the word convert rather than proselytize, because proselytize is, you know,
is something different, right? And we use language to get at all of that. So I think it's really great when people say to somebody else, here's how I see the world, or here's how I live, or here are the convictions that I have. Come with me in that. Come join that with me. Mm. So frankly, not enough of the progressively minded people that I hang around with are comfortable doing that. Mm-hmm. They'll say something like, well, this is kind of what I think, but I don't want that to fall onto you.
And vice versa.
Don't push it on me, but, you know, like, hey, you know, invite. And I think invitation is a totally different thing than I don't, you know, whatever's not invitation, all the other things that are not invitation.
Yeah. And vice versa. Those who are on the conservative evangelical side don't venture into other conversational circles because we all have limited time. Yeah, so we have to prioritize and choose our conversations and whatever it is that we feel called to do.
Yeah.
And we're recording this on the end of the week of an online conference that was run by Leadership Network, with whom both of us have a connection. And did you get to peek in and look at some of the tweets? What do you think?
I only looked at a little bit of the tweets. It was pretty quiet when I looked. There didn't seem to be a lot. And I was a little concerned at there, and I expressed this to some of the people, because I was there in Nashville where they did the live stuff, you know, so some of the people organizing around. And I was just a little concerned for them that they don't only think about the people on Twitter and how they're responding. Mm-hmm. Because I'm a Twitterer, and I know that I'm different than the people who aren't Twitterers. Like, mm-hmm. There's something there. Someone will, you know, figure out great, more grand descriptions of that, but there's something to that. So I was a little concerned that they're only worried about how much sort of trending you're going to get on the tweets. And look, and that's a good measurement. You know, I was swimming today, and there was a point where my heart rate got up really high, and it was fun. And I was like, oh, this is a great workout, right? So there's something about that measuring, like that moment when the thing is going high. But that's not the only measurement of the swim today. That can't be the only measurement of my day. That certainly can't be the only measurement of the, like, if all I'm doing is driving that thing up and not doing it, there's just an imbalance in that. And I'm sure they're on it and they're careful about it. But when you don't have enough measurements, you end up using the few measurements you have in ways that you might not want to be using them. Mm. And so I worry a little bit about that with people on social media. You know, they want to know like how many views and how many followers and how many trends and how many likes and how many retweets. And that's all okay. But that's
less than 10% of what's going on.
Of what's going on. Or even what we want to have going on, you know. But also, you know, sometimes you put things out. You know, I put up a little video last night that was really meant to only be useful if you watched it in the next 45 minutes, right? Because I put up this little video that was doing juicing in my house with a friend, and a guy named Christian Pyatt was going to be doing a book reading at my house. And so I put up this thing that was like, hey, you know, in 45 minutes, we're going to have this this book reading, and we're making some juices right now because the two of us are juicing, and showed the juicer. Like, that was it. It was not meant to be – it's not meant to sort of last. So there's lots of little short conversations, and if 35 people interacted with that thing, great. And other things, you want 30,000 people to interact with. And so anyway, I'm far off. I'm far afield here, but I think that that's why following the tweets is just such a temporary measurement.
Yeah, so. Very much so. I mean, even the half-life of tweets is like less than 2 hours. That 95% of your interaction happens within 2 hours, and then it's gone. It's off the screen. And so I was able to look at the schedule of the nines, and I saw your name towards the bonus section. So I don't know, out of time, and you didn't quite make the cut. What did you want to convey to people about Culture Crash?
I only made the bonus section?
Yeah, there's like 4 or 5 videos. I saw your name in the bonus section, so... When people buy the package, they'll hear from you, but...
Oh, they didn't show them.
No, if you want to sneak some out, that would be awesome. Because I found 3 people that snuck them out.
man, he's not going to keep me down.
Out, but
yeah, no, that doesn't bother me at all. But it does say a lot. You know, I for the people that tended to contribute to that, and some of it might have just been my production value, and you know, I don't have a face for video, so it might have been all that. But I was also on a very different. I had drawn different conclusions on many of these culture crash issues than other people. Yeah,
okay.
There was a particular, that event, and I used to work for Leadership Network, so I know them too, well, so love them. It's great. Right. You know, I mean, I have no problem. It's just different. It's differently conservative than it was when I was there. And I recognized that when I was there, at this particular event, that, oh yeah, yeah. Those kinds of views that I hold, you know, especially in the big ones, well, almost fundamentally just on the issues of homosexuality, or, you know, on the two that kind of wrapped around that, which was the sexual changing mores and gay marriage. You know, on the marijuana one, I'm actually an old fuddy-duddy on that. So that's not a big deal. And a couple of the other ones weren't really Christian civility, you know, I'm like, hey, I think we should listen to each other and be open and pay attention. Stop being a mean person. So that's nothing radical. Shouldn't be anyway. But boy, they were uncomfortable with that. I mean, even though they wanted to sort of engage in the issue, it was pretty clear. I did a panel on immigration on that thing. So I was asked to comment on the immigration.
Yes.
One, because I have two sons who are Mexican. Why?
Okay.
I mean, they didn't immigrate. They were born here, but their grandparents didn't. Anyway. So I was on that one. And the host of that event called The Nines, the online host,
yes,
a guy named Ed.
Yes.
Ed Stetzer. Yes. And Ed said, at the start of the little section, he goes, yeah, so Ed said, hey, Doug, you're the only person here that I know of who performs same-sex marriages, but they put you on the immigration panel. That's kind of putting on the muzzle, isn't it? And so he says, you know, they're putting the muzzle on. And I didn't feel that way. I'm like, look, people know that folks perform same-sex marriages, and they could find out that I do that. I'm like, they weren't. I didn't feel insulted or hurt or anything. It just wouldn't have been more interesting, I think, if I talked about that than talking about, you know, immigration for me. Because I think differently on why, as a person who was compelled by my faith and compelled by the story of the Bible and compelled by Christianity to perform same-sex weddings and to support gay couples and others. Not everybody knows people who've concluded on, say, same-sex marriage from a biblical perspective, right? Some do. I mean, you can find that. I'm not the only one. It's not unique. I mean, in fact, it's the Bible. It's, in my view, to come with any other conclusion, you've had to do some pretty fancy footwork, which I used to know how to do, and I just can't do it anymore. So I don't think it's all that shocking. But most people don't have access to people who have made those conclusions or think like that. And yeah, but it was funny. I thought, like, you know, 25 years ago, if I was sitting in that room, if somehow I time traveled and I was sitting in that room,
well, you listening were there.
And I was listening to me now, you know, I was me 25 years ago. I listened to the me 25 years ago would have thought, what happened to that guy? Right. You know, so I get it that it can feel so like, I don't even know what's happening right now. But God's able to do more than we could ever conceive or imagine. So
there we go. Thank you so much, Doug. Great talking with you. Great seeing you.
And great seeing you. I hope our paths cross in all the other good ways as well.
Thank you, Doug Padgett, for joining us on the Social Media Church podcast for this conversation. You truly demonstrate generosity with your time and energy to just share your perspective on your faith journey. And at the show notes, socialmedia.church/104 for episode 104. You'll see links to connect with Doug Padgett, as well as his 7 books. And his 8th one that is coming out in February 2015 is titled Flipped, The Provocative Truth That Changes Everything We Know About God. So if you don't mind hearing and engaging with the progressive side of Christianity, where Doug has found his voice and place, he has some interesting ideas. You can check that out. And our website is at socialmedia.church, where you can find the previous 100+ episodes, as well as subscribe and also add your voice to the conversation using any social network that you prefer, or you can use the telephone too. The number here is 9493-543216. The number again, 9493-543216. And email works too. You can say hello at socialmedia.church. It's time to wrap up this episode. My name is DJ Chuang, and until next time, let's stay connected online.